Welcome, listeners, to WGTD HD Radio, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. I'm Linda Fleshensky, the host for our program, Heroes in Our Midst. On this program, we highlight those who have made a difference in usual and sometimes unusual ways. Today's guest is not only very interesting, but he has had quite unusual experiences. For with us today is Nick Commande, a retired Racine firefighter who began in 1988 to climb mountains for charity. His book, in fact, is called Climbing for Causes. He began in Africa with Mount Kilimanjaro, and from there he went on to climb mountains in five continents, facing danger, illness, a plane crash, personal highs and lows, and other challenges. But through it all, he was always raising funds for charity. In his work, he truly deserves to be called a hero in our midst. Thanks so much for being with us today, Nick.
You're welcome.
It's so nice to have you here. You know, it was hard to know where to start with this very interesting story, Nick, but I just thought we should go back to the beginning. How did you decide to take this on, to climb mountains for charity? Were you already a climber, or did this just come to you?
Oh, I jumped into this with no knowledge of mountain climbing whatsoever. It all started with seeing a picture of Mount Kilimanjaro and making a snap decision. This is where I wanted to go. This is what I wanted to do. And with the 2 months I had to prepare for the climb, I turned it into a fundraiser for muscular dystrophy.
Wow. That is so wonderful. When you, because you were a firefighter, so in firefighting you do practice climbing, right?
Yes.
And did that help you a lot in what you did with the mountain climbing?
Well, yes and no. You had a basic knowledge of ropes with the fire department, but it's two totally different types of things. You know, we always had ladders and things and such for, you know, climbing up the sides of buildings if need be, but it's totally different than being on a mountain.
That is just so amazing. Your family must have been like, what, climb mountains? Was everybody really surprised?
They weren't too thrilled with the idea at first.
What was that first climb like, that Mount Kilimanjaro?
Oh, it was a real eye-opener because I learned so many things on that first climb. I learned about, for example, thin air. Racine, where I live and grew up, we're so close to sea level. I never experienced, you know, the air up at 19,000 feet before. So that was a real eye-opener. And me being in my prime at 30 years old, I thought this is going to be a piece of cake, and I was so wrong.
What does the thin air do to you?
Well, it just wears you out. You have no strength, no stamina. I didn't train for thin air. You can't train for thin air, where later on in my mountain climbing career, I learned to train for endurance, which made a very big difference. But I never experienced thin air at that time.
Wow. How do you train for endurance? I was going to ask you that.
Well, people do different ways. You know, people run, and they run longer and longer and longer distances. For me, climbing, I started out on a Stairmaster with 7.5-pound ankle weights on each ankle, and then I started wearing a backpack with 5 pounds of weight and then 10, and I worked that all the way up to 60 pounds.
Wow.
And I would do that every day, and that's what helped me train. And between my first climb up Kilimanjaro and my second climb, it was a completely world of difference.
Because you were so much more prepared.
So much more prepared.
And anything else about that first climb that surprised you?
The feeling of exhilaration that I had when I made it to the top.
Wow,
it was a big goal, and it was a big challenge, and at times I didn't think I would make it because I was not prepared as I should have been. But the feeling I had when I made it to the summit of Kilimanjaro was unsurpassed.
Amazing. And you were, I suppose, exhausted, kind of, but exhilarated.
Oh, yes.
At the same time. And you were about 30.
I was 30, yep.
Do climbs like that, do they take a physical toll on you? Like when you finished Kilimanjaro, do you have to... I was thinking this morning about that swimmer that I saw last year who went this long, long distance swim, and she just looked exhausted and really... Well, I think was a little ill after for a while, but do you have, after that first month, do you have to just kind of come down and get better? Or?
Oh, no.
No?
No.
Fantastic. Wow. Can you share with our listeners how these climbs actually benefit charity? Like, where does the money come from? And on that first climb, what was the cause for that one?
My first climb was muscular dystrophy, because firefighters always raised money for muscular dystrophy. So I thought it would be only proper that I do it for them. And people would pledge, you know, like a nickel for every 100 feet or a dime for every 100 feet I climbed. And, you know, when I made it to the top of the mountain, if you pledged a nickel for every 100 feet, I think the goal was like, or the total was $9 and some odd number of cents, and all the money was turned over to muscular dystrophy. All the climbs came out of my pocket. Nothing came back to me. Everything went to the charity.
It's amazing. So it was just totally volunteer to do this. And who pays, though, for, how do you pay for the equipment that you need and the cost that it takes to climb the mountain?
I paid for it all.
Oh, my gosh. Huh. I thought you would get that out of the pledges or something, because it isn't that cheap, is it?
No, it wasn't. And depending on where you climbed, the cost is greater.
Wow. And then did you advertise for the pledges?
Yes. Okay. Local papers helped me out. I hung flyers in businesses, had friends help, did door-to-door. Because this was, when I started this, the internet was not as prominent
right. As
it is today, where, you know, you can't put something online and have people send in tons right. And tons of money. Where everything I did back then was, you know, door-to-door and word-of-mouth.
That's true. I remember that, because now, really, if someone has a physical illness and they need some, you know, they can go. There are websites that you can go to and raise money mm-hmm. to try to help you with your cancer or whatever. What are some of the causes that benefited?
Muscular dystrophy, the American Diabetes Association, the American Cancer Society.
Wonderful. Amazing. After Mount Kilimanjaro, I read that that was in 1988 that you climbed.
Correct.
Then in 1990, you climbed a mountain that I have trouble saying. My husband, when he was working, he traveled to Argentina a lot. So when I said, how do you say this? Aconcagua. And he said it just.
Aconcagua.
Yep. Aconcagua.
Aconcagua, the highest mountain outside of the Andes at 22,835 feet.
Wow. I did actually look up some of these. So I'm amazed you can just remember them like that. And another exciting adventure, and I did read that mission was aborted at 21,300 feet when the mountain is 22,835, mm-hmm. so close to the top. Could you tell our listeners what happened that you had to stop?
Just extremely bad weather, high winds, extreme cold. You know, we pushed on for the summit at our normal start time, and we knew we just weren't going to make it, and weather conditions were changing, and they weren't going to get any better while we're on the mountain. So the decision was made to turn around and come back. And as in mountain climbing, any mountain, common sense must dictate all.
Mm-hmm. And when you say we, I meant to ask you this before. How many people would go on these climbs with you?
Different climbs had different amount of people. When I did Africa, I think there were 8 or 9 of us. And then when I think there were 11 of us on Aconcagua, my first trip up Elbrus in Russia, there were just 2 of us.
Wow. Wow. That would be a little bit scarier, or no?
No.
I'm just in there together, going up those mountains. It's just such a wonderful story. When you decided that you had to turn down, were you terribly disappointed?
Yeah, because you spend months and months training for something like this, and you spend a number of days on the mountain, and you put your body through a lot, and it's mm-hmm. a lot of exertion, and it's a lot of frustration, but you have to understand that common sense must dictate, and you either come down the mountain to live to climb another day, or, you know, be put in harm's way, and nobody was going to do anything that was going to injure themselves or another member
right.
of the party.
Right. You know, I understand you often dealt with extremely low temperatures on some of the coldest and remotest mountains, peaks in the world. How was it with temperature? Like when you were at the bottom and you were starting up, and you must have all kinds of equipment for all kinds of weather, is that right?
Correct.
And so when you start out, I suppose you almost get hot when you got all this other equipment, or no?
Oh, yes. When in Africa, when I started climbing, I started to climb out in shorts.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, the day you hit the summit, you know, you've got your, you know, longest pants on, your long underwear, wind pants, snow pants, whatever, windbreakers, Gore-Tex liners, just everything. And in Antarctica, you know, you wear cold weather gear all the time.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Did anyone get really sick from the cold, or
in our particular party, no.
Okay.
I think I may have been one of the worst ones. On Aconcagua, when I went back to try to climb it again, I ended up with a bronchitis and a cold so bad that I coughed so hard I cracked a rib.
Oh my gosh. And then did your family say, will you stop? Was there any point where they asked you to stop? Did they, by the way, go with you?
No.
I didn't mean even on the climb, but...
No.
I read something about a plane crash. When did that happen, and was anyone hurt in that crash? And it was your team? Or?
It wasn't our team. The plane crash was in Antarctica, 6 hours after our flight landed at the Patriot Hills base, camp. There was another tour team that was coming in to climb a mountain, and their plane crashed roughly 6 miles from our camp. And that's when our climbing team became part of the rescue party. There were minor bumps, bruises, but one particular gentleman, he was asleep when the plane hit the ice. The propeller broke loose off the plane and cut into the fuselage and hit him. So until a rescue flight could take care of him or could fly him out, we took care of him with his injuries. The rescue flight came, 38 hours later? And the man, I was able to talk to him about a year later, and he was still in a halo device for his leg. His left leg was shattered, left arm was shattered. Wow. Skull fractures, teeth knocked loose, and internal injuries.
Wow. So for over a day and a half, you were the rescue team.
Me and another person in the camp.
Man. And your paramedic experience was...
Well, I was not a paramedic at the time. I was only an emergency medical technician.
Okay.
At the time.
Did that lead you to become a paramedic?
I always wanted to become a paramedic. That's one of the reasons I joined the fire department.
Okay. Wow. It's amazing. And then I think your next climb was to the highest mountain in Europe, Mount Elbrus. Excuse me, at 18,500 feet, I read. Was that kind of your aim, was to go to the highest mountains on different continents?
There was a time in my life where I wanted to do all seven summits, which is the highest peak on all of the continents. And that was just one of the ones in line. Elbrus was not my highest mountain, and we had got weathered out on that one. Extremely bad weather, an extremely freaky time of the year. And
you had high winds, I read.
Yep. We sat there for 3 days waiting for it to clear, and it didn't. So by that time, the supplies are running out, and it's time to go home.
Yeah.
And just to show you how things changed, when I went back a year later to reclimb the mountain, we climbed it in a near-record time.
We did
the whole mountain in almost 24 hours.
Really? Wow.
Yeah, we started.
Yeah, because even that one, the first time when you had to abort the climb, I read you were at 17,100 feet on an 18,500 foot mountain. So you're just about there.
I know you can see it there, and it's
can't get there.
It's discouraging.
That money was for the American Diabetes Association. What happens if you don't make it to the top? Do people still...
People still pledged. If they pledged 100 feet and I only made it 17,000 feet as opposed to 18,000 feet, that's what their pledges were.
And then when you repeated it the second time, that was 92, I think. So you reached the top that time.
Yes.
And then you raised more money for it.
More money for American Diabetes. Yes, we did it again. We did it twice. And a lot of people said, well, you didn't make the mountain, but we're going to give you the whole pledge anyway. So it was nice.
It's very nice. It is such a unique idea just to do this. And did you ever hear of anyone who had done that before? Or this was just out of your thinking?
I've always tried to find out if somebody climbed a mountain as a fundraiser in the past, and I wasn't able to find anything concrete. But since I've done it, a lot of mountains have been climbed for fundraisers. A couple firefighters in Washington State, I think they climbed Mount Rainier for burn camp.
Wow.
Jansport climbed Aconcagua. In fact, when I was on the mountain for my second time, there was a team of women breast cancer survivors that were going to climb the mountain.
Wow.
So since I started it in 1980, the idea has really taken off, and a lot of other people have climbed mountains for charity.
Wow. You really were a trailblazer in this whole area. It's amazing. Then in 93, you climbed Mount Vincent. That's the highest mountain in Antarctica.
Correct.
At 16,000 feet. And that was for which?
That was for the American Cancer Society.
Yes. And was there anything different about that climb?
That whole climb was just completely different from the logistics down to the climb, because just getting down to Antarctica, was a real challenge. And that was my most expensive climb because it's, you know, there aren't commercial flights down there. There's a special tour group that would bring people down there. And even though Mount Vincent is only, you know, just above 16,000 feet, because of the ozone, the air quality of that mountain is the equivalent of a 20,000-foot mountain. And we had extremely bad weather there, too. And when the weather gets bad there, it's really bad. We had wind chills of minus of 140 degrees.
Oh, my gosh. So then you went back to Mount
Aconcagua.
I tried. I practiced at home.
That's okay.
And that's the time that you got pneumonia, right?
Yes.
And still you raised money for, that was American Diabetes Association. Wow. And so that after that, you did stop climbing mountains. Or I don't know if you've completely stopped, but you stopped your climbing.
I did. I stopped expedition climbing after that. The same passion that I had when I first saw the picture of my first mountain, decided that's what I wanted to do. That switch got flipped, then I decided that's it.
Yeah. And you certainly, oh my gosh, all the time and effort you put into this and the money that you raised for causes, it's just incredible. You have a great mind for thinking up things, and when I was looking up your things on the internet, I came across the baby child safety things that you do for flights. Can you tell our listeners a little about that?
That's the baby beer flight vest for lap children on airplanes. It's a device that I bought for my daughter, who my wife and I, we are flying, and she was a lap child on an airplane because we couldn't find an extra seat on the plane. So because she was under two, she'd be able to fly on our lap. So this was it's a little vest that goes around the child under their arms and between their legs, and it attaches to a parent's seatbelt. So if you hit turbulence, the child does not become a projectile.
And you didn't create that, but you are just kind of actively involved in promoting
it. I think it's a great idea.
It is.
I think every person that brings a lap child on board an airplane should have one. I mean, there are people that use car seats, and car seats are a great and wonderful thing. The person who invented the vest invented it because his sister took her child on board an airplane, and the car seat would not fit.
Yeah, and also, actually, if you don't pay for an extra seat, a lot of women, especially with men with young babies, don't get the extra seat, so the child is in their lap.
Right, and because not all car seats will fit in all airplanes, this particular child ended up riding on their parents' lap, hit turbulence, and ended up in the seat in front of her. Mm-hmm. And that's why the vest was invented. And it's a great thing to have. Even if you take your child out of a car seat and bounce them on your lap for a while for nursing, feeding, playing with, or whatever, you have no idea when turbulence is going to hit, and you don't know when that child's going to need that extra protection.
Right.
It's very cheap insurance to have one of these vests for lap children on airplanes.
Yep. I hate flying, but we fly a fair amount because our daughter and her family is across the country. So we go a lot of times a year out there. And I just hate that turbulence. And I know, I sincerely believe that it's more dangerous to drive than it is to fly. There have been so few, relatively few of any accidents in recent years on planes. But that turbulence is just, it comes so suddenly, as you pointed out.
It does. And that's why the FAA will not mandate that all passengers have their own car seat. It's called the diversion rule, because if they tell you that every person, including children under the age of two, has to have their own seat, less people will fly for due to reasons of economics and lack of room on airplanes and that, and more children will be killed in car accidents than they will be in flying.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
You should always protect, and that's why the baby beer safety vest is a great thing to have, because it will protect your children in the air, and you should give children all the protection you can, whenever you can.
Absolutely. When did the book idea come to you? The Climbing for Causes, which, by the way, is available on what site for our listeners?
You order through Barnes & Noble's, or you could go to authorhouse.com. You can look at my website, climbingforcauses.org. It can be ordered on Amazon. I mean, any web search, you could find it.
Excellent.
But the book idea came out about 8 or 9 years after I started climbing, when I was looking through one of my journals, because I always kept a journal on the mountain because it helped pass the time to do things. And I thought this could be a book. Mm-hmm. So each chapter of the book is a journal from that particular climb.
Wow. Fantastic. And you also do some public speaking?
Yes.
Some presentations. So if anybody's listening out there who would like to have Nick come and talk to a group about his experiences, he would certainly look at that. Is it a slide?
I do a PowerPoint presentation and a motivational speak that talks about mountain climbing, the pros and cons of it, what you get out of it.
Was it much of a leap to go from your journal to turning it into a book?
No.
No,
it was relatively easy, actually.
What would you say were your scariest experiences in climbing?
Scary experiences.
Did you ever slip?
No.
No.
Well, everyone slips. Sometimes you sink into the snow a little bit. I had one of the members in the Antarctic. I was second person on the rope when he fell into a crevasse. You know, the snow cracked underneath him. But, you know, everyone remembered their training, so nobody was hurt.
Mm-hmm.
How
do you train for falling into
it? Well, you practice doing belays and rope rescues and things like that. You know, kind of some of the things you do on the fire department. You know, like I said, and the fire department gave me my first working knowledge of ropes.
Okay. Yeah, I've seen that training that firefighters do for that. Do you ever dream about climbing? Do you have dreams at night?
I haven't dreamt about it in a long time. You know, I used to.
Mm-hmm.
And it was fun. You know, it was one way to get away from everything, because when I first started climbing, I don't even think there were satellite phones yet when I first started climbing. So you're pretty much, you know, on your own. You're away and cut off from everything.
Yep. Something. And what were your best experiences? I mean,
Anytime I made it to the top of a mountain,
that was
it's like, okay, let's cross this one off list. No, it was great, because you know, it's like a runner, you know, finishing a marathon. You train for months and months and months, and you finally, you battle the weather, the elements, the gravity, you know, and when you finally reach that goal, you know, I don't want to say cross that finish line, but you get to the top of the mountain when you can't go up anymore. It's just a great feeling.
Mm-hmm. I should have known this or asked you before, but do you have children? Do they climb?
I have one daughter, no. My daughter, Rachel, she's almost 13. No, she's not a climber.
Uh-huh. She's got to be impressed, though, looking back on what you did.
Oh, I hope so.
Oh, man, amazing. You know, you don't climb at all now, Nick?
No.
You know, in life, I always think whatever we do, whether it's or happens to us, good experiences or bad experiences, we learn something. What kinds of things overall did you learn by doing this?
What did I learn? I learned a lot. I learned not to take a lot of things for granted. I met some very wonderful people on the mountains, and I'm still friends with a number of them today. When you spend that much time together with people or sharing tents with them, you know, it becomes close. Like being at the fire department, you know, I had my family at home, and then I had my family at the fire department because I was there 24 hours a day, every other day with them.
Mm-hmm.
And it was always great, because you had other people that worried about you. You worried about them. Everyone took care of everybody. Everybody was in for a common cause. And, you know, on the mountains, the cause was getting to the top of the mountain, being on the fire department. It was, you know, putting out a fire, helping someone on the rescue squad. It was a team effort.
Mm-hmm.
It was always a team effort on the mountains and especially at the fire department.
Yep.
You were always worked at a team.
Mm-hmm.
No one person could be singled out for doing something, because you always worked at as a group.
Right. And I think, you know, that's true of life in all things we do. If we can come together as a team and work for a common goal, the results can just be outstanding, as they were in your case. Would you say it took you some courage to do this? I mean, were you scared
to climb mountains?
Yes.
Well, it's the first climbing Kilimanjaro was not your typical climb where you used lots of ropes or anything like that, because it wasn't. Kilimanjaro is so close to the equator that your temperatures during the day, you know, were comfortable or cool, and it wasn't until you took that final summit bid where you hit the extreme colds and saw the glaciers up on top of the mountain. You didn't need specialized equipment for that. Whereas, you know, the other mountains, it was a lot more training and more stress because you were a little bit more in harm's way and you had to be a lot more careful.
Yeah, yeah. Was it hard just physically lugging all that stuff? How does that work that you can take? Even food, how do you get enough food up there?
Well, in Africa, we had a support team. We had people that almost, you know, they'd be the equivalent of the Sherpas on Everest that would carry stuff for our lower camps. And on the other mountains, we had one base camp where everything was set up, and we would rest there for a day, and then we'd take a whole bunch of our supplies, move them up to camp two, leave them there, and then go back down to camp one and sleep at night. So you'd gain some altitude during the day, and then you'd sleep at a lower altitude at night. Climb high, sleep low. That was the model. Huh. And so then, you know, after 2 days of doing that, you then move the whole rest of your camp up to camp two, and then you would supply stuff from camp two up to camp three, go back down, sleep at camp two, and then move the camp up again. So you're leapfrogging the entire time.
Uh-huh. Huh.
So, you know, in essence, you've climbed the mountain twice.
Yeah, I should say. Wow. Whereas, I would never have guessed that, actually.
When we did Elbrus, we didn't have to worry about that because we just made that one-day push, took what we needed, knew it wasn't going to be an overnighter, didn't need tents, didn't need sleeping bags. We had warmer weather, which was a big help. My summit pictures of Elbrus when I made it to the summit, my jacket's open, and the sun's out. I don't have gloves on. Where the picture of the high point on Elbrus, which is also the cover of my book, the winds are howling, the snow is blowing.
Beautiful
I'm all
picture.
Bundled up.
Yeah.
In fact, when I saw that picture when I get back, I said, if I ever wrote a book, this would be the cover.
So when you're finished, when you get to the top, you don't climb down, right? A helicopter picks you
no,
up?
No, you climb down.
You climb down.
Yes.
And then what's the range? Like you said, that one mountain you could do in 24 hours. Mm-hmm. What's the longest it took?
Again, it depends on the circumstances. The trip to Antarctica, my entire trip was supposed to last 12 days.
Okay.
From flying down there, getting to the base of the mountain, climbing the mountain, coming back. But because of the plane crash, that delayed us 2 days because we couldn't fly into the mountain because it was snowed in. That took several days. And then after we climbed up the mountain and came back, we had to wait for the weather to clear for our flight to come pick us up. So my 12-day trip ended up being, I think it was 26 days.
Man. Did you take vacation time?
It was all vacation time.
Wow.
Where, you know, in Elbrus, like I said, we did that up and down in a day. On Aconcagua, we climbed that. It took us 9 days to climb to our high spot and 9 hours to climb back down to base camp.
Well, this program went so fast. I have to end it here, but I often conclude this program with a quote. So I found this following quote by a blogger who read The Climbing for Causes and wrote the following. The tale of this firefighter humanitarian captured my heart. It replaced a belief in mankind, a belief that there is a genuine good left in this world. There are people who actually do amazing acts of kindness in an effort to bring attention to worthy causes such as diabetes and cancer. They play by the play-by-play of the mountain climbing of a man who, with no prior experience but overloads of determination and passion, grasped my attention and interest just as if I were climbing those mountains alongside him. I love that quote, overloads of determination and passion. I'd like to thank our guest today, Nick Commande, for the good that he has done for so many causes in his own unique and energetic way, for demonstrating your determination and passion to make a difference, and for being with us today. We thank you, Nick.
Thank you very much for having me.
And finally, thanks to you, our listeners, for joining us today. I'm Linda Fleshensky, and we hope that you go online at WGTD.org to hear this and other of our Heroes programs, and that you will tune in to WGTD HD on the 4th and 5th Saturdays of the month at 10 a.m. for more editions of Heroes in Our Midst. We salute the hero in all of you. Take care.